This talk is offered by Ordinary Mind Zendo. Ordinary Mind was founded by Barry Magid, Dharma heir of Charlotte Joko Beck, and is dedicated to her vision of a psychologically minded Zen practice adapted to the needs of American students practicing in the context of their everyday lives. Our public programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
I've been reading a little book called Culture by the Marxist literary critic Terry Eagleton. And culture is a peculiar two-sided word that put me in mind of other two-sided words connected to our practice. Words like intersubjectivity, interconnectedness, and emptiness, and enlightenment. And these culture, like these other words, is two-sided, because it refers to both something that we cultivate, we have to acquire or develop, as in when we say we become cultured, and at the same time, it describes something that is already omnipresent, something that exists in the background and is the medium in and through which everything else happens. In that sense, you talk about belonging to a culture or speaking a language or belonging to a tradition. And everything that you understand or try to do happens within the context of that language and that culture. Now, it goes back a long way to, certainly to the Greeks, to make some contrast between nature and culture, as if we can begin with a dichotomy around who or what we naturally are, maybe biologically are, and what is a cultural add-on. And through a lot of history, there was an idea that nature meant something like an essential nature, a biological given, and that culture is what was adaptable. And yet, today we live in a culture that is progressively chipping away at or rejecting any notion of essential or intrinsic human nature, rejecting previously assumed biological givens, particularly around things like race or gender or intelligence, right? And seeing these more and more as social, cultural constructs. It's interesting that Eagleton points out that while we have, while we reject so many things as being essential human nature, as if that resigns us in some way to having to accept them as a natural category. He says it's literally easier to move mountains than to remove sexism. So that to call something cultural is not to say that it's so easily malleable. Now, if we want to bring some of this a little closer to what we're doing here, I might point out there were all a bunch of Americans sitting on these very strange black cushions that are not found in too many American households. That we are practicing or enacting something at the intersection of Western and Asian, and particularly Japanese culture. And there's sort of a basic question of what's involved in trying to do that. Some of you have seen the little documentary about A Heiji that circulated on our listserv a little while ago. And it's, you know, a remarkable picture of life in Japanese Soto Monastery. And I've known American Zen teachers, ones who have trained in Japan, who have said Zen can't be said to come to America until we construct an equivalent, if not a replicant, of a training monastery here, so that Americans can undergo exactly the same kind of training and live really the same kind of life that monks do in a place like Heiji. See, that's a certain kind of assumption about what it means to try to import something from one culture to another. How possible is that, right? To what extent is studying Zen studying how to be Japanese, right? And could you do that, right? Part of what Eagleton discusses in the history of the notion of culture is how we developed this idea of culture as something that shapes our world and our sensibility. And this is an idea that's usually attributed to Johann Herder, romantic German philosopher at the turn of the 18th and 19th centuries, who really formulated the idea that a language and a culture completely shapes a worldview. And this was in reaction to the Enlightenment that tried to propose something like universal reason as a kind of cosmopolitan lingua franca, something that everyone everywhere would naturally share in. And that the dream of the Enlightenment, in a way, was the end of certainly religious difference, but also in some way cultural difference as the language of science became more and more universal. And there was a big reaction against this. See, in a way, this was an enormous cleansing idea of the Enlightenment, that we would no longer be bound by religion and by local custom. And at the same time, there was a counter movement that said, the liberation is real, but the solution you imagine is fantastic and unrealistic. And one of Herder's contemporaries, Edmund Burke, in particular, vehemently objected to the French Revolution because it was carried out in the kind of Enlightenment fervor of, we're going to wipe the slate clean, we're going to get rid of religion, we're going to get rid of kings, we're going to get rid of all the traditions that have shaped society up to now and start with a clean slate. And it's just going to be based on these very great principles of equality and fraternity and what's the other one?
Egalité.
Egalité, that. And Burke basically said, this is going to be a disaster. You can't ever start something from first principles. Societies have to grow and develop organically. And in terms of the French Revolution, he was one of the first, the only people to predict the course of the terror and the way the country dissolved into chaos. In any case, this whole notion of culture as something that is defining a worldview is the question that we deal with when we try to import or integrate aspects of another culture. You know, at one end of the spectrum, there are people who sort of maintain that cultures and worldviews are incommensurable. You know, that the world completely looks different to someone who is Japanese than to someone who's American. When I was in school, this was called the Whorfian hypothesis, that the language, you know, shapes your worldview. And Worf was an anthropologist who studied, I think, the Hopi Indians, and sort of said the way that their language shapes a picture of the world that is incommensurate with our own. Right? And yet, somehow, cultures collide and interpenetrate. The Renaissance happened, right? There was some way in which the wisdom of classical antiquity got integrated into the medieval Christianity of Europe, and a Renaissance occurred through their intermingling. Somehow something is happening when we bring these Japanese forms and ideas to America, right? And the question is whether we will be proudly mongrels, right, and feel that that kind of intermingling is the point, or whether we think that, no, what we've got to do is figure out how to really breed, you know, pure, you know, Japanese monastic people over here, right, so that the tradition is preserved. Right? Now, returning to the sort of two-sided nature of culture, though, to turning to the side in which we cultivate something. You know, in the chant before the talk, we speak of holding and maintaining something here, right? This Dharma is something that we take responsibility for holding and maintaining. And I would say constantly redefining and recreating as we go. And that there's a way in which we're doing that internally as well, that our practice involves a commitment to cultivate ourselves, to refine ourselves, to develop ourselves in certain kinds of ways. This is a practice of discipline that, if nothing else, requires a lot of showing up and a lot of sitting still and a lot of staying with the kind of experience we might otherwise choose to avoid. There's an effort involved in that, right? And in doing so, we become a certain kind of person. As I've talked about, there's a nice analogy between this practice and just practicing making your bed every morning. And the point is not just to have a made bed, but to become the kind of person who makes their bed. Right? Zen is a lot like that. Point is not just to sit still, but to become the kind of person who is able to sit still. Right? The kind of person who stays with rather than reacts. And yet, everything that we seek to understand about our true nature in this practice, it is not something that we have to cultivate. It's something that's already there. That's the other side of those words, like interconnectedness and emptiness and enlightenment. See, we don't bring any of those things into being through our practice. All those things are what's already here, right? Emptiness or impermanence is already the nature of things. Interconnectedness is already the nature of things, right? Enlightenment, in a sense, is simply the recognition of the way things already are. So how do we put those two halves together? It's a strange practice in which what we cultivate is the discipline to stay still and allow things to be just as they are. Because the way things are is unfortunately not to our liking. As the old man said, life is suffering. And part of what we discipline ourselves to do is stay in the midst of that suffering. And that suffering is precisely defined by the realities of impermanence, the loss of attachment that we want to hold on to, and interdependence, which means we're constantly subject to and vulnerable to forces outside of our control. And that's the simple reality of what life is. So what we're doing, I think, is borrowing and reforming and recreating cultural containers that allow us to develop the discipline to become the kinds of person who can sit still with those realities, right? Who can develop the capacity through many years of practice to leave everything just as it is.